Ron? You got to turn it on first.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. Fishing, tear it off. Fishing in, tear it off. Welcome everybody to the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We are, as I understand, entering our fifth decade now.
Formed in 1977.
77, yeah. Been around for a long time. I was in diapers then. We try to choose speakers and topics that are diverse and challenging. And just as an example, in the upcoming semester, we have the environmental history of dormant communities, confronting death, compassion, the value of the 21st century, free will versus determinism. So if you want to find out what all the lectures are going to be in the winter and spring, check with the Dallas Philosopher Forum webpage or meetup.com, and we will have calendars up there, I'd say within a week or two, for all the ones starting in January. David Drum back here is our treasurer. He'll be happy to accept your $5 if you haven't paid yet, $2 for students with IDs. We're a pretty cheap date. We've been meeting here for a number of years, and management's kind enough to give us this space, which really meets our needs. The music is wonderful, too. If you order food and drink, please pay the bill. Otherwise, we get stuck with it. And also, please take care of the wait staff. Be generous. Tonight's lecture will take about 45 minutes with time for Q&A afterwards. And we would ask that you arrange your thoughts into the form of a question so that the speaker will have a chance to answer it. Tonight's speaker is Bill Bernstein. He was born in Dallas, attended the University of Texas in Austin for his BA. He then moved to India, where he lived for several years, 12, I believe you said. After returning to Dallas, he received his Master of Science in Counselor Education from the University of North Texas. Since 1996, he served as Deputy Director of Mosaic Family Services, an agency serving those who have suffered human rights abuses such as human trafficking and domestic violence. Bill will be speaking with us tonight on the philosophy of ancient India. So please help me welcome Bill Bernstein.
Thanks a lot, Skip. Thanks for having me here, everybody. And I'm going to start with a little basic first. I want to say, while we were having dinner there, I was talking to Mr. Saranjit, and he was saying, it's philosophy club. You can talk about anything. And really what that reminded me was the way I graduated college, because as Skip said, I went to the University of Texas in Austin, and my last year I was trying to figure out how I was going to graduate, because while I was in school, I had no idea what I was going to do. I was taking any kind of different class that I was just interested in any way. And when I went to see, to look at all the different possibilities, there was really almost nothing that I could graduate in without taking a bunch of additional courses except philosophy. Because in philosophy, really, whatever you took was okay. I mean, you did have to take a minimum of philosophy classes, but you had to get by with that. So yeah, tonight I'm going to talk about the Advaita Vedanta, which is a philosophy. Before I talk about that, I want to tell you a little bit of something that has almost nothing to do with what I'm talking about, but it's just interesting, something I learned first in college and then very recently. So when I was in college, I took a class on Sanskrit. I was trying to use Sanskrit as my language. There also I got away with that. That wasn't a language that you could really use, wasn't a permitted language. You had to have two semesters of a language. Sanskrit wasn't one of them, but I convinced the dean to let me do that, so I managed to graduate there. But it was being taught by a well-known linguist, and he said that the languages of North India, Sanskrit, as well as the languages spoken today, such as Hindi, Marathi, Bengali, and all the languages, as well as the European and Western languages, like what we speak now, these are the Indo-European languages. So they all come from the same language stock, Indo-European language. The South Indian languages come from a completely different language stock, different root. which is really pretty fascinating, and I couldn't understand that. What that means is that English is closer to Hindi than the South Indian languages are to Hindi. I wondered about that. Now, there's a lot of similarities, so there's been cross-pollination over the years, a lot of different words from Sanskrit in both North and South Indian languages. But just maybe a couple of 3 years ago, I saw a special on PBS, National Geographic special, about the origins of humans. And that's really where I learned the difference. So humans came out of Central Africa, Namibia, I think about 70,000 years ago, they guess, and a group went up through Africa, and then they headed east and went through Central Asia, and then up through the northern China, and then crossed over through the land bridge into the Americas. And that group had gone through the northern part of India when they were migrating. And about 5,000 years later, or maybe more, I've heard 5,000, another group had left, taken some of the same route, but then had gone a little bit to the south, and had gone through South India, and then across land bridges to Southeast Asia, like Indonesia, the countries over there, like, really, it went pretty far, but even to Thailand and Cambodia. And so that's how you have completely different language groups there. And again, just something that fascinated me, because this is the kind of group that gets interested in a lot of diverse things, I thought I would just throw it out there. So I've got my notes. I had to go back and remind myself of a lot of things, because I left. I lived in India for 12 years, as Skip told you, and I moved back about 30 years ago, so it's been a while. It's a philosophy that I was deeply immersed in. I'll talk about that. But once I moved, my thinking and my own personal philosophy changed over the years. And so even though it affected me, that's really not the philosophy through which I see the world. But that's what we're going to talk about today. The Vedas were written, they estimate, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, the Vedas were written. The Vedas are the ancient Hindu texts of India. And from the Vedas, the texts at the end of the Vedas were what's called the Upanishads. So the Upanishads were a philosophical perspective on life, and because they come at the end of the Vedas, they are called Vedanta, which literally means the end of the Vedas. And the basic philosophy of Hinduism comes from that. You know, that's the root, Vedanta, which is from these many dialogues that have been written, many scriptures, the Upanishads. So when I talk about the philosophy, it's going to sound familiar to in some ways. So there's going to be some similarities to certain aspects of philosophy that we might have studied in the West. There's some phenomenological aspects to it. I'll even sort of touch a little bit maybe on quantum mechanics and see if anybody has anything to say about that when we get going. But what I'm going to talk about, again, it's based on what I learned when I was there. But a couple of books I read, I studied under a teacher. He had studied under a teacher who had written a couple of books that were really, I think, incorporating or interpreting a lot of the ancient philosophical texts and philosophies into more relevant modern terms that people could relate to a little bit better and understand. So that's where my learning is coming from, and everything I talk to you is really based on that. One thing I'd like to mention as we get started is that one of the things I read when I went back to sort of review some things is that understanding Vedanta is not easily done from a sort of an objective perspective or from an analytical or academic perspective like we're doing now, like I'm doing, we're all doing, that's, you know. But the only way really to understand it in the ancient scriptures, what is said is the only way to understand it is to immerse yourself in it and be a true aspirant. So, you know, maybe some of us are here today, but if we're not, then maybe try to put yourself in that mindset to try to follow that way of thinking so that we can sort of see where we're going all this. Because, you know, again, I'm just somebody who's studying the thing. In ancient texts, the only person who's qualified to teach this kind of thing is actually someone who is initiated into that, who has a guru, who himself becomes a guru, and then is able to pass on that information. So that's in the tradition anyway. So I sort of want to clarify all that as we get started by that. So in Vedanta, there are three main branches. So there's Dvaita, which is dualism. There's Vishishtadvaita, which is modified non-dualism. And there's Advaita, which is non-dualism. So those are basic three branches of Vedanta. dual, and the way I've heard it explained in a very simple way is that Dvaita Vedanta, you can interpret as there is man and God. Vishishta Advaita, or modified non-dual Vedanta, is there is man in God. And then the strictly non-dual Advaita is man is God, but in that concept, there is neither man or God. Both have disappeared into the basic, what could we be in Sanskrit words, Atma or Brahma or the Absolute. So I'm going to tell you how I got into that, and then I'll talk a little more. As I mentioned, I went to UT in Austin, and so when I was a junior, which was really not quite 50 years ago, maybe 49 years ago, so I was sitting at the start of the semester, I was looking through the whatever it was, the thing that you look through to pick your classes, catalog. And, you know, back, sorry?
The catalog,
yeah, it's good, we have some money. So, And you know, of course, back in those days, you didn't do it online, right? You had to go to the gym and wait in line to see if you got your classes. But anyway, I was looking through the class, and I had never, one of the classes you have to take is history. I hadn't taken history. So there was another class at the same time as the history class that I was going to take called Mahayana Buddhism. And I was trying to decide, should I take history or should I take Mahayana Buddhism? And my roommate said, you know, when are you ever going to get a chance to take a class like this in Mahayana Buddhism? You know, go for it. You can take history anytime. But in your life, you're never going to do this kind of thing. And it so happened that my brother, who's many years older than I am, at one point, he had sort of mentioned that he took a class in comparative religions at SMU. So I don't know if that was in the back of my mind. But anyway, my roommate recommended this, so I thought, you know, maybe I'll give it a shot. Of course, he didn't do it, by the way. He stuck with his business major and never took anything anywhere approaching liberal arts. But anyway, so I went into this classroom, one of the old buildings at UT campus. You know, it's still there, but of course the campus looks pretty different today than it did then. Even then, I think it was one of the older buildings at UT. But this meeting, this class was in an auditorium. You know, not a giant auditorium because it was an old building. So obviously it was a popular class. The auditorium filled up pretty rapidly. And pretty soon, every seat was filled. There were people sitting in the aisles and standing around the corner. The room was really packed. It's a pretty good thing the fire marshal didn't show up, because today that wouldn't have stood. And so we're all sitting there waiting, and then this elderly gentleman walks in. He's wearing this sort of Nehru outfit. It was, you know, heavy dark black pants, dark shirt with a Nehru collar. Most of you probably know what that is, and you know, it's I don't know, end of August, early September. I mean, it's probably 100 degrees, but he seemed comfortable. So he walks up, he goes up to the lectern. Dead silence falls over the room, and I'm sort of going to go into it a little bit about the way I got into it to sort of give you a little bit of an idea. So he puts his head in his hand for a minute. Everybody gets quiet. Don't you feel, aren't you aware that you were there when you were a very young child? You remember what you thought when you were a young child. You remember what your body was like, how you moved around. As you grew older, when you were a teenager and started doing other activities, you remember what you thought then, how you thought about things. You remember what your body was like then. Then you grew older, and you became a little more mature, and you became an adult. And you remember what that was like, and you felt you were different then, but you're very aware that that was you. You were there. Your body was different. Your mind was different. And throughout every stage of your life, it was that way. If you were limited to that body and that mind and changing along with it, how can you remember change? If you change along with something, can you be aware of the change? So there is in you a changeless aspect, which is who you really are. And that is how you have observed these changes in the body and mind, which you are seeing. So you see the body and mind change from that position of changelessness. When you feel, when your mind becomes restless, because we identify ourselves with the body and mind, we want to know something. We feel like we need to know Why is the sky blue? Why is it when I drop something it falls to the floor? I need to know these things. Once, so you seek objects, you seek knowledge. Once we know something, the mind comes to rest. And our mind comes to rest not because of anything to do with the object, but because we've reached back to that basic knowledge. Similarly, our mind is restless. We want to be happy. So we seek something that's going to make us happy. Imagine for a second a moment when you were really at the height of happiness. Something happened that you just enjoyed so much, you're just feeling just complete joy. At that moment, is that object there? You have just come back to yourself. Again, the mind was restless. Once it was fulfilled, it comes back to itself, and we feel that simple happiness. And again, not happy. Happy requires an object, but happiness itself. And in the tradition, maybe many of you might have heard words like Satchitananda, and the first thing that I talked about with that in you which is changeless, that observes the change, is sat, existence. Chit is knowledge, the consciousness, that pure awareness, not awareness of something, but awareness itself. Happiness is ananda. We've probably heard that in different ways if we haven't heard the others. So that's the meaning of those ancient expressions of Satchitananda. And that's the foundation of the philosophy that we're talking about. So, you know, we have a lot that we can talk about with regard to those things. Are we not in there? What's going on? And, you know, I'll try to leave plenty of time for questions so that we can talk about all these different aspects. When after studying all these things, you know, having sitting through this man's class, or really, you know, not just one class, but I sat through one semester, then the next, I don't remember, maybe a couple of 3 years, I was sitting through this class, finally got interested enough to really pursue this further, started reading some of these ancient works and different stuff, ended up going to India. And the format of learning where I was the Socratic method, question and answer. So people ask questions, and the questions were answered. And, you know, I used the expression Socratic method very loosely because this was, you know, a good deal before Socrates. So, but that was really the way of addressing things, because the idea is that people are seeking answers, and the only way of attaining something is by getting answers to those questions. So to come back to some of the complications of the philosophy itself, in ancient texts, meditation was tattvam asi, that thou art. So the idea is that you are that. And then that changes over time to aham brahmasmi, means that I am. So where it comes to what we were talking about, that basic nature of our real nature, which philosophically here is Satchitananda, so that basic consciousness or ananda, which is the real nature, the meditation would be that is what somebody is. And over different, I guess, milieu or different long aeons, this was perceived in different ways or pursued in different ways by people in India. So at one time they thought of the absolute in terms of the universe, so a larger thing. And other times it's thought of in terms of one, the ultimate self that one is, that changeless principle in you. Ultimately, the idea is that they are the same. We can't separate the universe from ourselves. When we see an object, this is a concept that over the years, you know, I've seen a lot of discussions about. Ultimately, can an object exist independently of your perception of the object? Now, there's, obviously, we know there's Western philosophies that have maintained that, and we don't think about them a lot, but if you delve into that, your perception of an object is the object. Can you verify that an object exists when you're asleep? I mean, we assume that it's there. We assume a lot of things, but what we see right now, ultimately, that's all we really know. I mean, we have thoughts, so if we have thoughts of other objects, those themselves are thoughts. And you know, you can see that as we get into this sort of discussion, we're going pretty far out of the limb here. We're talking differently than we're used to thinking, and that's one of the reasons at the beginning I said that to really understand this, you've got to sort of put yourself in the role of somebody who's really aspiring to go there, to understand that. an object is something that is being seen by you. In other words, again, back to that concept I said a minute ago, you see the chair. So the chair is not independent of your seeing. And if we think about that over a long period of time, it's really hard to refute that simple logic. I mean, we can, I'm trying to go where I might think about this in terms of my own life, because I don't live with this concept on a daily basis. But if we just take time to think about the actual concept, the reality is, can something exist without your awareness of it? Can you prove that? That's a difficult thing to prove. You can only prove it by what somebody else tells you, or by a thought, ultimately, which comes to you. It's hard to refute the basic logic. When we see change in the world, can that change exist, again, independent of our perception? And that's where I like to mention, I don't know if it's, it may not be quantum mechanics, we have to turn to the resident physicists here with this, but what I did learn was, when I tried to study these things a little bit, is that when science was trying to come to a conclusion of whether light is a wave or a particle, when it was investigated in many different ways, what was found was light is either a wave or a particle, depending on how it's being perceived. Is that not correct? I've been verified physically. But that is the reality. Light is both a wave and a particle. It depends on the perceiver. So that simple, I mean, that's something that if you talk to any scientist who understands the way the world is viewed today by the latest concepts in physics and in science, they will verify that. And that sort of verifies everything that I'm talking about now. I mean, the existence of just about anything is determined by the viewer. And really, quantum mechanics, a lot of what quantum mechanics has to say about the structure of the universe, I mean, not the universe, really, it comes down to the structure on the minutest level of, internal, small, subatomic particles. But basically, the perception is part of the existence of what that is. It's just we're stretching it a little farther here by making it clear that what you see is what you get. I mean, that's what's there. So, in the philosophy itself, the basic theory is, one of the basic theories is that the approach, there's many different approaches to the truth, which are all okay. They're all accepted. All religious concepts are okay, because the philosophy that's within this Vedantic perspective is that there may be many different paths, but they all lead to the same place. Ultimately, that's where you're going to end up with anything else. I want to come back a little bit to the part of you that was really aware that you were changing over the years, that constant part that didn't change. So when your attention goes to that, the object that you thought was being perceived by you as a structured body and mind is not there. So again, that's the path to this, that's the path to the absolute or the truth that's viewed from this perspective that we're really trying to go with here. One nice example of that I learned was that the sun shines in its own light. So the sun isn't aware that it illuminates all the objects we see. Everything we see is illuminated by the light of the sun. At least before there was electric light, but we're not going to go into that. But everything we see is illuminated by the light of the sun. The sun just shines. So in the same way, that which is your inherent existence is that through which you were able to see the different objects. We superimpose things on that as we go along. So we superimpose a lot of things on the consciousness. Again, one of the concepts is that, what we're talking about is theoretical knowledge here today. What would be said in the ancient texts is that you can only really understand this by approaching it directly, trying to go there. Another interesting concept was about sort of cause and effect, or just about the world. Because according to this concept, and we don't talk about whether the world exists or not exists, but if there's only consciousness and it doesn't change, I'm not sure where that leaves the rest of the world. But let's take that for a second, the fact that if we try to sort of look at things like that, let's go back to the origin of the world. And by the way, on another note, the basic another perspective from the religious ancient religious texts of India that I read was real similar to the Big Bang Theory. That's sort of the way the world originated. And then it sort of goes in a little bit of a different dimension. But that's a distraction. Back to what I'm talking about. If we try to ask, how is the world created? You know, why is there a world? From the standpoint that we're trying to reach here, the standpoint of something which doesn't change, something which is independent of change, which observes change, can't change if it's observing the change. How then was the world created? When we ask a question like that, that question is asked in terms of the world. So we're assuming that there is a world when we ask a question like, how did the world start? Where did the world come from? Why is there a world? Those questions are only asked in terms of the existence of the world, not in terms of the existence of this immutable principle that we're trying to reach here. And you might ask yourself, what was there before the Big Bang? You know, science will say, well, there was no before because there was no time. I mean, I have trouble grasping that, but that's the theory, right? I mean, the Big Bang started time and space. There was no space, there was no time. Well, what does that even mean? How did that happen? But, you know, the reason I'm quoting that simple theory is because in a similar way, we're saying here that the existence of the world is something that we ask in terms of the world. What was before the Big Bang? Well, that question is asked in terms of today when there is time and there is space. And in terms to ask about something before that, it's a little challenging. Okay. We also think we're the one doing something, right? So, again, it's a question of why do I do this? Who's doing this? What's going on here? If you ask yourself that, the question itself superimposes the existence of somebody that's doing something. Every question we ask that comes in about this, about the world, is in terms of the world which we're saying we're trying to understand in a different way. We're trying to go to the basic concept of our own existence. That's what any philosophy is trying to do, isn't it? We're trying to go somewhere. And as I said before, you know, I talked about happiness and about consciousness and knowledge. Again, the philosophy would be those do not exist outside of yourself. We seek those because we identify ourselves with the body and mind. We think we're seeking something outside the body and mind. We look for that. When we find any of those things, we come back to ourself, which is happiness or consciousness, and therefore we relax and we see what is really ourselves. So what we're experiencing is only ourself. And again, remember that what we remember is not only the objects that were there in our lives at different points, but we remember the person that was there. If you are that person, can you remember that person? I mean, I can see this wall because I'm not the wall. Can I really remember this person that I was 50 years ago or 10 minutes ago if I'm that person? If I'm changing with that person, can I remember that person in the same way? In the philosophy of ancient India, what we call the individual soul is referred to as jiva. Jiva is really a combination of jiva is sort of the definition of individual soul, which means there's some identification. It's sort of connected with the body and mind. It would be viewed as a superimposition of what we are, what we view ourselves as being as a body and mind, superimposed or connected with that which we really are, which is this pure consciousness. And so we talk about the individual soul in those terms. That's the way this philosophy would view it. There's a lot of sayings that I've written down here. That which sees cannot be that which is seen. And that which is seen cannot be that which sees. Those seem like very simple concepts, but that's right at the basis of what I'm talking about today, isn't it, right? That which sees cannot be seen. That which is seen cannot be the seer. if we look at that in a pure way, then we really come back to that. Because if something changes, it can't observe that change. You know, and another thing, again, that was said, to take it even farther, we see birth and death as changes. Again, we are not part of that because we see that. Happiness, again, I'm repeating a lot of things because it's a pretty different way of thinking that I'm talking about here. When you're really at happiness, is there an object present? Is there seeking happiness is really... And by the way, you know, I work in a nonprofit agency. People say, well, that's really, you know, social work. You must make you feel good to help people. This is anything that we do, and I believe this wholeheartedly, anything, and even though I may not think in some of the terms that we're talking about, anything we do is to reach happiness. I believe absolutely. Even something which is completely selfless, that's what makes us happy. If I do something that's really selfless, it's because I'm coming back to what makes me happy. Because whatever philosophical or religious thought I bring to myself and operate my life under those auspices or under that umbrella, it's ultimately to reach that, to bring myself back to that happiness. So, bottom line here is, what does that mean? That happiness is ourself, that is Ananda. That's the aspect of happiness that we were talking about. Consciousness, that other aspect that we talk about, which is the Sanskrit word is chit. Again, we're seeking objects because we see them as different from ourselves. We think we will know something, but really it's just bringing us back to ourselves. So part of the basic idea that one of the things we're saying here, which is really not easy for any of us to grasp, is that according to this philosophy, reality itself, the basis, basic, what the ultimate reality is independent of thought. And if that's the case, how can we reach it through thought? How can we go to that, to attain that reality? Well, what we know is that that real I is the perceiver, right? We've been talking about that. That's what sees things happening. If it really is the perceiver, it can't be perceived. So how do you get there? The answer to that is, if everything else is removed, that's what remains. So that might get a little far-fetched to think that we can remove everything from that absolute nature which we really are. But it's just a question of going there step by step, by understanding what we aren't, removing what we aren't by thinking about what we really are. You know, we equate knowledge with knowing and happiness with enjoying, but they're really... These happiness and knowledge are states that exist when actions cease. In the same way, we equate experience with actions, but what is the essence of experience itself? Is there a cause for experience? Is there a cause for your very nature, for that I which sees all these things that we're talking about today? You know, are these objective experiences the cause of what you feel at the level of who you are yourself? Or is it something more? Is there something fundamental in you which sees all this? So under this way of thinking, we're sort of establishing that the world is what we see. Can consciousness create the world then? Back to the idea of where does it come from? We're saying that objects, that whatever we see is a part of consciousness itself, and not separate from it. How do they come into being? You know, one example that's given is that water comes into contact with something distinct and different from it. It comes into contact maybe with air, motion, gravity, and therefore a wave is produced. You can't produce thoughts in that way. So we can't even ask really where thoughts come from. Form is an object of seeing. Same thing with sound. You know, there's the old conundrum, if a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear the sound? What are we talking about when we say sound? When I say, if a tree falls in the forest, you're already imagining a sound. So you're projecting a sound, so that's a thought. So we can't ask the question, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody is aware of it, does it produce any results? Because we are there. When we have that concept of the tree falling in the forest, that itself is a thought. That's what brings us to talk about all these things. Another good concept from this basic philosophy is the idea of different states of being. For example, we have dreams. How real is a dream? According to basic Advaita philosophy, and by the way, I should have delineated that more carefully here. I talked about the three, that Vedanta has three aspects, dual, modified, non-dual, and dual. So what we're talking about today is pure non-dual Vedanta. So in that, when you're in dream, is what you're dreaming real? Is what you see real? Is the person that's there real? And of course the argument would be made is that we could wonder the same thing about right now. Because when we're in the dream, we don't believe it's a dream. That's reality to us. And that's just one way of showing, are the objects in a dream real? If tonight you go to sleep and you have a dream, and you're dreaming about this room with these tables, is that real? Or is it a dream? Is it any different than what's happening right now? So that's a philosophy that it's just something that we can think about as we try to, you know, we're trying to understand different philosophies here. If I ask, are you a conscious being? Anybody would immediately say, yes. And I'll keep my hand down. It won't do that if I keep my lip down. when I ask you, are you a conscious being? And you immediately respond, yes. Where does that answer come? You're not thinking about anything. You're not thinking about yourself as an entity or anything. It's just automatic. It comes from the deepest level. There's consciousness there. I made some notes that are just a little repetitive, but, you know, hallucination. How real is a hallucination? How real is a dream? We see those things as real as what we're seeing right now in our waking state. We cannot be what we see. So bottom line, we cannot be what we see. That's one of the fundamental aspects of this way of thinking, of the Vedantic philosophy. If we are an object, we are not. If we see an object, we are not the object. Can we be what we see? We see our body, we see our senses, we see our mind. We say, I'm this size. I'm maybe bigger than I used to be or smaller than I used to be. I lost weight, I gained weight. I feel this. I've got it. We remember feelings we have. We remember thoughts we had. We're very aware of that. Can we be that which we see? You know, again, can the seer be that which is seen? I see something. Can I be that thing I see? Or am I something else which is independent of those? Is the happiness that we see in the objects, or is it in ourselves when we feel like we need that object, and we get the object, and we come back to ourselves, and we're relaxed, and we feel that purest happiness? So I think that's pretty much a summary of what I have to talk about. It's a pretty different way of thinking than a lot of things. It's a philosophy club, and we're going to some serious philosophy here. It's a little different than a lot of philosophy, but it's got a lot of similarities also to various different things. So I think I'm fine with slowing down and taking questions. I don't know if I'm the best person to answer the questions, but I'll give it a shot. We have a mic. Yes.
You have a question? You're closest.
Yeah, at the beginning you talked about three aspects of Vedanta, right? You mentioned God. Now, is God just a thought in our minds, or is it reality?
You know, according to the basic philosophy, it doesn't. A way of approaching reality is through God. God is viewed as part of the universe. So, you know, whether we take that as a thought or not, it's part of the universe. But it's something that I think the basic answer to that from somebody who maybe knows more than I know, somebody might say that it's a healthy way to think. In other words, believing in something like that which is higher than ourselves is a step towards the absolute. According to Advaita Vedanta, it might not be the absolute. There's some lines, and I'd like to actually quote something from a book, but I'm a little reluctant to do that because of the recording. Is it possible to pause it for a second? Or can we not? If you can't.
Yeah, we can pause it for a second.